This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we'll have an update about the Cape Breton Maisonette and what you can expect for the weather for the rest of the fall. The CEO of Destination Cape Breton talks about the new proof of vaccination policy, as well as a Cape Breton golf course being recognized as one of the best in the world, and a look back on the comedy of Huey and Allen with a Cape Breton journalist and musician. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Terry Smith of Destination Cape Breton weighs in this week on the new policy for people showing proof of vaccination, and he's also going to tell us about Cabot Cliffs and Cabot Links getting high praise from Golf Week magazine.
So the tourism industry was really one of the first hit, and it's probably going to be one of the last to fully recover from the pandemic. When the pandemic hit and the first wave hit, and we had the roughly 3-month shutdown, it was really devastating to our operators. And even then, after it did open up back in the summer of 2020, Cape Breton Island is a destination where almost 80% of our visitors in a regular year come from outside of Atlantic Canada. So even though we had the Atlantic bubble, it really didn't come close to generating what a normal tourism year would. Now, it was somewhat encouraging over the winter. We saw some good traffic, lots of snowmobilers coming, for example. And then this spring, we got hit with another shutdown, which impacted things. And then really, with the new rules in place, with the reopening of the province, we didn't really see travelers start to come back in any great numbers until late August, kind of early, late July, early August, and since then, though, you know, it's been decent numbers, and the fall is looking pretty good. So you know, the demand. And from all of our campaigns, we're actually seeing the demand, the traffic that's being generated to our website, and then from our website out to operator websites, it's actually better than it was in 2019. But the problem is that there are some supply side constraints that operators are dealing with. You know, the labor shortage right now is at a crisis point. And that's certainly affecting how much business operators can handle. So there are things like that have been maybe not caused by the pandemic, but have been exacerbated by it.
There are many employers who say they can't find staff right now, and even had to close their doors temporarily for a day here and there. So why is it so hard to find workers right now?
Well, you know, it's actually a complicated mix of issues that are affecting that. And we had in some communities staffing shortages before the pandemic hit. So, you know, things like the lack of housing in some communities for what would be employees in tourism businesses, that was impacted. We saw last year, normally there would have been a new cohort of international students coming to Cape Breton University that we didn't see in 2020. And that really impacted the availability of labor, because those international students have just been really a lifeline for the industry. They filled an awful lot of places with an awful lot of needs. You know, there are still some support programs that people are still able to access right now that can keep them on government supports instead of going back into the workplace. So there's really a whole combination of things that are impacting things, and the demographics of our community. You know, our population are kind of domestic population has been shrinking for a number of years, and that impacts it as well.
Terry, I wanted to ask you about the cruise ship industry being sidelined because of COVID-19, and it was expected to stay that way until February of next year, but then the federal government announced the industry will resume early next month, but Sydney won't see any of those ships coming in for this year. But do you see this as an opportunity for planning for the next season, and what kind of work will it take to fill the void on missing out this year?
Yeah, well, there's really not a lot you can do to replace that traffic that would come in. I mean, you know, it was just a tremendous. I think it was over 230,000 passengers that were forecast for 2020 before the pandemic hit. So you know, that's just a significant amount of business that that we haven't seen, and we really can't replace in any other way. So seeing cruise ships are coming back for 2022 is really positive for us. We do have some work to do. We've got to ensure that that our community is welcoming again to cruise ships. You know, the cruise ships were kind of a place where people did see COVID outbreaks. But all of the cruise lines have taken really strong steps to ensure that they are safe again and are able to travel again and to communities in a safe manner. So it's only going to be more so as more people get vaccinated and we go into 2022. So we're really encouraged that the cruise industry can come back and it can be safe for those visitors to disembark in our community and get to see what Cape Breton Island has to offer them.
So with the new policy of providing proof of vaccination, it getting mixed reviews, most people seem to be on side with the government in seeing that communities are vaccinated. But that procedure that is necessary in showing proof, so far, how are the groups dealing with it that you represent?
Well, I have to be honest with you, it's a little bit cumbersome for the businesses that do have to enforce those rules and do all of the checking at their operations. You know, it's we're asking people on the front lines to do more at a time when all of those businesses are struggling to maintain staff. So anything that can be done that can alleviate that demand on businesses to be doing that checking, I think would be very welcome. We're encouraged that, you know, for the next month, it's going to be the kind of eyeball, I guess, check, but that there is a QR code solution that's coming, and so that technology can be used that can reduce the burden on staff of businesses. So the sooner we can get that in place, the better.
It was interesting what the Premier, Tim Houston, said recently, where he called out the protesters, basically telling them to leave the workers alone. They're simply just trying to do their job. And he went as far as to say, blame me or blame the government, but leave those workers alone. And I think he even said, if you see me, you can flip me the finger, but it's not their fault. Leave them alone. Just let them do their jobs.
Yeah, you know, I really feel for the workers. They're just, a lot of them are overworked because of this labor shortage. They're being asked to take on this checking process, and it's really not their fault. They're not the ones that are setting the policies. They're just carrying out and trying to do their jobs the best way they can. So you know, I would ask people to just be a little bit more patient with them. You know, service levels are likely to be impacted because of the current situation. And we just, you know, have to treat each other like fellow human beings and just be a little bit understanding. Like the Premier said, if somebody has a problem, they can certainly talk to the government about those issues.
Terry, this might be a better question for the province. They had talked about this a number of times as of late, but can you briefly describe when and where is proof of vaccination required and when is it not?
Yeah, I can speak in terms of the tourism industry, and it would be required for anybody going to full service restaurants, like dining in establishments, liquor licensed establishments, the casino, some fitness and recreation facilities, some indoor and outdoor leisure facilities and businesses that offer classes, indoor and outdoor festivals, special events, conferences, theater performances, concerts, things like that. That's where people are going to be asked to provide the proof of full vaccination.
Okay, thanks for that. Just to switch gears before we go here, Terry, some good news about some very popular destinations on the west side of the island, Cabot Links and Cabot Cliffs, the latter being named the top international golf course. And that was by Golf Week magazine in the U.S. You must have been pretty excited to hear that.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful accolade. And Cabot Cape Breton, the whole resort property there, is just it's just phenomenal. And it's truly been a game changer for the tourism industry on Cape Breton Island. It has made us into this world-class, desirable golf destination. And, you know, it's no surprise to me that they're getting these wonderful accolades, but it's wonderful to see. That's just going to put Cape Breton Island on the bucket lists of many avid golfers out there to want to come to visit and to play those courses. So we're just thrilled, and we want to congratulate the whole Cabot Cape Breton team on the fantastic work, and going right back to the designers of those courses.
Yes, that work's been underway for a very long time, like you say, with the designers, and received other accolades leading up to this one. But can you talk about what is it that sets these golf courses apart from the others? Why is it such a desired destination for golfers?
Well, you know, they are traditional links-style golf courses, but being located right there on the coast, you know, right next to, well, in this case, the Gulf of St. Lawrence, but, you know, the ocean, really. And it provides spectacular views from almost every hole that will just take your breath away. Plus, as a golfer, I mean, it's almost playing old world style golf, like what they would expect to see in Scotland or Ireland on this side of the Atlantic, and that just holds that traditional appeal to people, and I have to say as well that Cabot, their service is impeccable. The experience that they deliver to their visitors is just phenomenal, and we hear only raving reviews about the experiences that people have, and kudos to them. They've really changed the face of tourism on Cape Breton Island, and we just wish them every continued success.
And you commented recently as well that the economic spin-offs won't only be seen in Inverness County, but they'll be noticed here in the regional municipality as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when somebody decides that they're going to come to visit the island, they you know, going to Cabot, golf is going to be foremost in their minds. But, you know, we even hear from the folks at Cabot that many of their guests are seeking other experiences that could be taking place all across the island. And, you know, whether that be some high-end culinary experiences, or maybe going fly fishing, going on a whale watch, things like that. You know, they're looking to experience Cape Breton Island, so it is going to pay off for areas right across the island.
Okay, so on that note, Terry Smith, CEO of Destination Cape Breton, talking about the new proof of vaccination policy and also celebrating Cabot Cliffs and Cabot Links golf courses being recognized by Golf Week magazine. Terry, thanks so much for your time. Have a good one.
Thanks, Bill. Great to chat.
Cape Breton Mesnet is a network of weather stations across Cape Breton reaching over across the causeway. Here is the founder, Jonathan Buffett.
Yeah, the Cape Breton Mesnet is a network of privately owned weather stations across Cape Breton Island and areas of the mainland. And it's a citizen science type of project that has involved a lot of people that live on the island. And over the last several years, we've been able to collect some pretty interesting data as a community.
What can you tell us about the local weather? At any given time, can you see a significant difference in temperature? Let's say if you're looking at somewhere like Inverness compared to North Sydney, are you surprised that you might see a contrast every now and again, even if communities are even closer than that? But do you see a big difference in comparing nearby communities as far as temperature goes?
Yes. Quite often there will be large differences in temperature or cloud cover depending on wind direction. And usually it depends on the season, but I know for one thing, in the spring when we often have southeasterly winds, kind of a cool and humid air mass, it'll often be cloudy, and also it could be raining on the eastern side of the island, while on the western side, due to the Cape Breton Highlands and even the hills around Inverness and Port Hood, it can be a completely different type of weather there, sunny and warm. And then the opposite can happen in a west or a northwest wind, where the eastern side of the island is much more pleasant and the western side is shrouded in cloud and quite a bit cooler. And then sometimes they're roughly the same. If we have a warm southwest flow, and that's more of a summertime pattern. There can quite often be pretty large differences between one side of the island and the other.
So this past summer, have you noticed anything interesting about the weather? And do you keep track of record temperatures? And did anything surprise you about the past summer season?
Yeah, this summer was very interesting for a couple of reasons. We didn't set any crazy temperature records or anything like that, but what was interesting is that June was quite a bit warmer than normal, and it was actually warmer than July in terms of average maximum temperature in the day, and that is very rare to have that happen. And then July was quite a bit colder than normal. We had a lot of rain, a lot of humidity. It was just very unsettled. And then August was much like June. It was warmer than normal, but there was a lot of sunshine. At the Mesonet station in Sydney Mines, for example, I've been collecting solar radiation data there for the last 11 years, and August 2021 was the sunniest month since the station was installed in terms of how many hours of sunshine there were in the month out of what there could have been, so the percent possible sunshine. So that was quite interesting. And every day of that month had at least 1 hour of sun, and there was 19 days had 10 or more hours of sun at that station. So that was really quite something. And it was dry as well. And then September has been quite warm, or it was quite warm, fairly normal precipitation. And October is looking pretty warm as well. Looks like we'll have some really nice weather well into the middle of the month.
Yes, a lot of people enjoyed the way the fall got underway here. Do you think the rest of the season will be like that? Do you think we'll have a milder than normal fall?
Yes, milder and drier than normal. A lot of sunshine, a lot of just fair weather. Not to say that there won't be, you know, some days here and there where it will be windy and cold and cloudy, but compared to what we might typically expect in October, it'll be certainly warmer and drier than normal for the next couple of weeks. And beyond that, it's, you know, really hard to say, but there's a lot of agreement in the long-range computer models that October will be warmer and drier than normal.
So it's probably not the right time to ask to get an accurate prediction for the winter. I'm sure you're asked that pretty often, Jonathan.
Yeah, the only thing I could really say about that is the sea surface temperatures, you know, in eastern Canada and eastern North America are quite a bit warmer than the normal. So that could have an impact on the type of winter we have, but that isn't a hard and fast rule, and we could just as easily have a very cold winter, and those warm ocean temperatures would not take very long to cool off. But yeah, I can't say with much confidence what it would be like, other than it's certainly going to be windy and cold.
So a lot of people enjoy going around the Cabot Trail this time of year, and I heard an interesting comment from a couple who likes to take that trip about this time around the Cabot Trail to see the colors, but they said they're going to wait a bit because it's still a little bit too green. Do you have anything to say about that, and have you heard similar comments?
So the colors tend to peak around October 15th to 20th, usually. Some years it might be a week earlier or a week later. This year, where we've had an extended stretch of, you know, mild weather into the early fall, haven't seen, in a lot of places, we haven't seen any frost yet either. So that would affect the, you know, the leaves. And they're certainly taking their time turning color. And I've noticed that the western side of the island seems to turn a little earlier than the eastern side. So around Sydney or Inganish seem to be the very last of the trees to really, you know, peak in color. And the western side is and mainland are often around a week earlier. It can depend where you are, but generally our colors peak quite a bit later than much of Canada. So I can see how some people might be caught off guard by that. And as for if they are changing later than they used to, I don't have any hard and, you know, fast evidence on that. I could, you know, we could really only know by asking people and, you know, hearing anecdotally what they have observed over the years. So I'm not too sure about that, but I know they tend to peak in mid to late October in Cape Breton.
So why is it that the leaves change colors starting on the western side of the island? That's pretty interesting, and it moves in this direction to the east, and it's the same for the country. It starts in western Canada and then moves to the Atlantic provinces?
Well, in terms of Cape Breton, western Cape Breton would be more likely to see earlier frost. There's more valleys, and it's a little closer to the mainland, so there's not quite as much modification from the Bredour Lake and the Gulf of St. Lawrence. I think that's probably why eastern areas of the island are later than the western areas. Now, as for Canada, that's a bit of a, I guess that's a bit tricky because Western Canada is higher in latitude than Nova Scotia, well, than Eastern Canada in general. So they're above the 49th parallel. Whereas once you get to Ontario, into Southern Ontario, we're all, you know, around 45, 46 degrees north or lower in latitude. So that can play a role in the fall. But beyond that, you know, it at least anecdotally, I suppose I also have noticed that it seems like the fall colors do peak later here, and we seem to have a nicer fall, at least in the earlier part of the fall, than they would in, you know, Vancouver or on the prairies, where it can get cooler, or in Vancouver it could get quite rainy in October and November.
Is there anywhere in the world, if you had the opportunity to study the climate or the weather in any place in the world, where would you choose? What do you think would be the most interesting place to study the weather?
I would be interested in chasing tornadoes, maybe. But that, now, I might have a different opinion if I was there in front of one. But as for actually deploying weather stations and studying the weather, I can't really think of a place that's more interesting than Cape Breton.
Really?
So,
yeah.
We pretty well get it all, and there's really not many places in the world that are quite like Cape Breton. We get the heat in the summertime, the wind, the snow, the cold in the winter. We've got lace wet winds in Shetty Camp. That alone is hard to find anywhere on Earth, and you know, many other things. So it's a very unique area to have a really dense network of weather stations.
Speaking of tornadoes, there have been situations here where forecasters issued tornado warnings, and I don't remember exactly when, but am I right in saying that? Do you know if we had any of that kind of activity recently?
There was two confirmed tornadoes on the mainland this past summer, which that certainly might surprise people. In 2013, July 2013, there was a tornado warning issued for Cape Breton County with a supercell that was moving. It moved off the island around Lewisburg, but I don't think it really ever developed anything severe, but it was a severe thunderstorm. So I'm sure they could happen, would be quite rare, but one of these times that, you know, we're probably likely to at least see some kind of warning for one if we have severe thunderstorms. And also radar technology is better these days with Doppler radar. There's a brand new one that was installed in Marion Bridge last year. So it's also easier to detect some of the finer details in a storm that previously may not have been visible.
Can you talk a little bit about that more? What is the Doppler radar?
Yeah, so the radar is it's an automated piece of equipment that it sends out a beam into the sky, and it will reflect off of precipitation. So it's able to tell how far away the reflection is and how, you know, dense or how fast it's falling and which way which way the wind is blowing. So that's probably the best way I can describe it. There's no one there actually operating it. It's automated, and that's all it does. It doesn't record any weather conditions other than what it receives in the radar dish.
So we all have these conversation fillers from time to time, people talking about the weather. We complain when it's too hot and then counting the winter days, hoping for the snow to go so it can be hot again. When a weatherman or weather person talks about the weather, is it a different kind of conversation you have? Do you ever get tired or bored of talking about the weather?
Yeah, I never get bored of this. I think the only thing that gets on my nerves is when people complain about heat. But just because it, you know, we get so much cool weather in the winter. However, in recent years, we have been actually getting heat and humidity that is worth complaining about. I will say that. So we certainly saw quite a bit of that in August. I love to talk about it, and it's very interesting, and often I learn things that I didn't know from other people in hearing what they've been able to see over the years and patterns that they've noticed. So, it's one of my favorite things to do. There's no doubt about that.
And what have you learned about the weather from talking to people other than collecting scientific data? Have there been any wise elder people sharing information with you to give you a better understanding of it? People who have been here for a while and they have a pretty good sense of what people can expect weather-wise for any given season.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things I've learned about, well, a couple of them. The first one is the localized winds that you get around the Cape Breton Highlands, either on the eastern or western side. So I've spoken to a lot of people that live there to really gain more in-depth knowledge about what happens there and how it happens. But also speaking to fishermen to hear what they have seen over the years, both with sea ice, if it's changed, where has it changed or how has it changed, and also ocean temperature. And so things like that you can really only get anecdotally from them or from people when you go so far back in time where there was no satellite coverage or there was no buoys or out in the water getting the water temperature. So that can be really fascinating to hear what they have to say and what they've seen over the years and compare to what we have now.
Jonathan, thanks so much for the talk, and hopefully we'll chat again sometime.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Put money in the parking meter. Put a penny in the parking meter. Put a nickel if you're gonna stay late. Can't you read? It says a violation. And if you don't pay, you'll have to see the magistrate. So I said...
That's Adam Cook, musician and journalist based in the Strait area. But there you heard his impromptu tribute to the popular comedy duo Huey and Allen. That's a video of Adam from his Twitter account strolling down Charlotte Street in Sydney. And here is Adam now. Before we chat about his news coverage and music in Richmond and Inverness County, a little word on his admiration for the late great pair Huey and Allen.
Well, I'll tell you, I've always enjoyed Huey and Allen, partly because they were so deadpan in their delivery, but by the same token, they managed to make a lot out of a little joke. And, you know, I fell in love with their material around the time that I started going to university in Halifax. Of course, it always takes a little trip away from Cape Breton to really appreciate what you have in Cape Breton. But at the same time, there were a couple of friends of mine in Lordways, where I grew up, that were doing regular impersonations of Huey and Allen and things like variety concerts. And their names were John Colin McLeod and Dwight Sampson. Dwight's brother Brent is actually a municipal councillor for Richmond County right now, so it's funny how these things all go full circle. But Huey and Allen undercut a lot of the pomposity and a lot of the facade and charade that often goes with daily life, not just in Cape Breton Island, but anywhere around the world. They were just two good old boys from rural Cape Breton, and they got right to the point. If they didn't like something, they'd make it clear, but they'd do so in a way that was guaranteed to make you laugh. They weren't angry or they weren't forceful about it. It was very subtle humor. Sometimes it was a terrible pun or that type of thing, but I found it was very subtle, very likable humor, and it still is to this day.
Adam, there's a note here from the Beaton Institute reading, Huey McKenzie and Al McDougall began their comedy act during the Second World War when they would entertain troops by telling funny Cape Breton stories. After the war, they continued entertaining people across Cape Breton Island and beyond on radio and television for many years. And Adam, if you haven't heard this recently, here's a little segment they did. It's called, Did You Get Your Pension Yet?
Well, Alan, it's good to get back talking to you again.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you came over. I'm here alone again.
Alan, tell me, did you get the pension?
No, I didn't get the pension, but Uncle Archie and Aunt Christie got the pension.
Did they?
Well, you sort of seen Christie, the poor old soul. She said, whenever I gets the pension, I'm going to send to town and get a dozen oranges. I've been wanting them for years.
She was always fond of oranges.
She gave Archie the check, and he went to town to cash it.
Eh?
He got into the brew.
He did.
It landed back about 3 days after. put the dozen oranges and a dollar and a half on the table.
Yes?
Christy says, well, for heaven's sake, if I knew the oranges were so dear, I wouldn't have asked for them at all.
They're worth the expense.
I'll tell.
Well, poor Archie wasn't very smart anyhow.
No, he was pretty dumb.
One day I said hello to him, and he was stuck for an answer.
Was he that bad?
He was that bad.
So there's some good stuff there, Adam. A little bit of the insult comedy thing there, but very clean. Do you think their humor stands the test of time? And do you think their comedy would connect with audiences today?
You know, I really do think it does. And, I mean, I speak with some bias because I've been a fan of theirs for the better part of 30 years. But I feel that the humor they have is very timeless, partly because of its delivery. And, I mean, you had somebody like Huey McKenzie who had the very light and airy voice, and he'd just come at you with all the enthusiasm. And then you had Alan McDougall, who was very, very straight on in his delivery. He didn't mess around with all the foolishness or the bells and whistles or anything like that. So it's fun seeing the two of them play off each other. And, I mean, chemistry is there, whether it's anybody from Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis to Wayne and Schuster to Kermit the Frog and Fozzie Bear. I mean, the chemistry really makes a great comedy act work, especially in a duo setting. So I always felt that Huey and Alan had that chemistry, and I think that that kind of endearing quality to their stand-up work and to their recordings is going to live forever.
And we had a chance to talk before we did this interview here, and you said you had a story to share, a connection with Huey and Alan. Can you tell us about that, please?
Well, I was very, very lucky in the mid-2000s. This was 2004, and we were able to continue this till 2007, to get an opportunity to do a 10-night show every September at the Lewisburg Playhouse, and we called it the Fleur-de-Lis Trail Players, because the majority of the performers were from Richmond County, so we wanted to have kind of a Richmond County name. And the second summer we did this in 2005, we were kicking the tires on doing some more specific to Cape Breton humor, and one of the other troupe members, Billy Joe Hines, came up with the idea of doing a tribute to Huey and Alan. And so I thought that's a wonderful idea. I've been a fan of theirs for years. But I thought, if we're going to do this, we should do it with the permission of the family. And, of course, both Huey McKenzie and Alan McDougall had passed away by this time. Alan McDougall had only been gone for about 2 years. But we tracked down a representative of Alan McDougall, and, of course, it was a family member. It was his daughter, Joyce. And I spoke to her, and I felt, okay, we're probably going to need to have a written contract, or where there might be a royalty fee or some such thing. Joyce could not have been kinder, and she said to me, look, you don't have to sign anything. We don't expect any royalties. The only thing that I ask is that you make it crystal clear that these are Huey and Alan jokes and that this is Huey and Alan material. And I thought, well, of course. I mean, it's a tribute to Huey and Alan. We're going to dress up like them, and we're going to talk like them. There was no way we would try to pass this off as anything other than Huey and Alan material. So Billy Joe Hines and I took the stage at the Lewisburg Playhouse that year, and we did it again in 2007, and we were actually able to take the Huey and Alan tribute and do it in a couple of smaller venues back in our neck of the woods, in places like West Bay and in Aerochat and Lewisdale, where we would do the Fleur-de-Lis Trail Players there. So we had a wonderful time with it, and I got to actually meet Joyce McDougall just a few years later at a Celtic Colors song session in St. George's Channel, not far from Dundee. And so she told me that she had seen the tribute and that she'd really enjoyed it, and it really meant a lot to me that somebody who was so close to either of Huey or Alan and gotten to see the act and seen how much it meant to these two gentlemen for so long was giving us permission to do it and gave us the family seal of approval. So Joyce, if you're listening, thanks again, and we hope we've done your father proud.
And what appealed to the audience here with Huey and Alan is that they would give commentary on current issues, but with a twist of humor. And here's a real cheesy segue here, Adam, to get into another topic here. But your day job, you give commentary too as a reporter. You've worked in print, radio, and television as well. Can you talk a little bit about your career in journalism, please?
Well, you know, I always wanted to be a broadcaster of some sort. I don't think growing up in the 80s in Lordways that I ever saw myself as a Peter Mansbridge type or a Lloyd Robertson type or any of the people on 60 Minutes or Jim Nunn or Jack Columbus or anybody like this. I did like the idea of being involved in media, and I always wanted to be a storyteller. And one of the biggest people that influenced me was not a journalist, but a former journalist who went on to great success in another medium. His name was Stan Johnson, and some of our listeners might recall the show Switchback that ran from 1981 to 1990 out of Halifax and played all over the Maritimes. But Stan Johnson, or Stan the Man as we called him, was a personal hero of mine because he could walk that tightrope between being informative and giving you all the information you needed about entering contests and about the music videos they played and about the guests he had. He could do serious interviews if he had to. But he was also such a funny guy that was completely irreverent and satirical when it came to the CBC. He was constantly making jokes about how the CBC didn't have much of a budget anymore or how their executives had 15 parking spaces or things like this. And I never forgot this tongue-in-cheek irreverence, and I always thought if I ever get an opportunity to do something like that, even in a news or media setting, I'll want to do that. So that's what led me to the University of King's College in 1990. I got my journalism degree there, graduated with a Bachelor of Journalism in 95, and through the 90s and the 2000s, my media journey took me everywhere from 5 years of AM radio work at CIGO in Port Hawkesbury, which is now 101.5 The Hawk, a combined 12 years of writing news, sports stories, entertainment stuff, and columns, weekly columns, for The Reporter, which is a weekly newspaper based out of Port Hawkesbury. And for the past 14 years, just started our 15th season, I've been doing twice monthly municipal council reports live on CBC Radio's Information Morning. So I didn't exactly wind up like Stan the Man Johnson, but I did wind up being a storyteller at this stage of my life, and I've really enjoyed that opportunity and glad to be able to do that through many medium, whether it's on radio, whether it's on TV with my work with Tallulah Community Television in Richmond County, or on the radio with the CBC, or even on social media. So I'm glad to be able to tell stories in many different ways at this point in my life.
And it's not surprising to hear you say that you're a fan of Stan the Man from Switchback. I have to say you do a very excellent job at providing that element of infotainment, if you will, in reporting. Very professional and accurate, but you seem to unbutton that top button and just kind of relax a bit and give a little splash of energy.
Well, I've always gone on the premise that just because there's news happening doesn't mean that it has to be dry or that it has to be presented in a very sterile, lifeless manner. And I mean, I'm always happy to bring some energy to what I'm doing because the way I look at it, I'm telling the stories of the people of our community and the people of Cape Breton Island. I go by a wise bit of advice that was given in the early 90s to me and other viewers of CBC television. They did a documentary on television production with Moses Zenheimer, who was the brains behind the Chum era, the Chum Enterprise in Toronto, Much Music, of course. And he gave his commandments of TV journalism. And the first commandment he gave was, the best TV newscast tells me what happened to me today. And I never forgot that, because it's one thing to say that you report on a press conference or on something that happened from a crime perspective or a political announcement or anything like that, but if it's not relevant to the person listening, then it doesn't mean anything to them, and they'll just whip right by, especially now in the digital age where you can find things on Facebook or Twitter or, go to websites of news sources or things like this. You know, if you don't like what you're seeing on TV or on social media with your news, you've got millions of other options. So I'm glad to be able to take that and present the news in such a way that, first of all, facts come first. You can't go without that. But by the same token, that it has a feel to it that makes people understand, I hope it makes people understand, why I'm taking the time to be able to tell not my story as Adam Cook, the reporter, but their story as the person living in the community that could be impacted by it. So I hope I'll be able to keep Moses Zenheimer's first commandment of TV journalism going for a long time.
That's interesting what you say there about people sharing news and information on social media. Anyone with an armchair and a computer now can scoop us, really, in newsrooms. But do you feel more pressure now as a reporter when it comes to competing with people sharing on things like Facebook and Twitter?
I'll tell you, I really don't feel the pressure right now, partly because of exactly where I am in my life and in my career. At Tlalit Community Television, most of the work I'm doing, I know it's going to take a couple of days to be able to get it together. We're not designed to be able to have the big scoop and have the big story online. I mean, it's something that is important to our viewers and to the general community is happening in such a way that we can put a little something on Facebook or a tweet or something like that. We'll do that, of course, with no trouble at all. But with other stories, it's going to take a little bit longer to edit them. We have more of a lead time because the shows that I'm doing for Tlalit Community Television are weekly programs. So, you know, I've got some time to be able to edit them so that while they may not be up to the minute or up to the second, just because we don't have the technological ability to do that, they're still going to be relevant by the time they come to air. And we're surprised and delighted by how people are sharing this material when we do put it on our own social media. So, you know, we feel we're making our impact both on the air and on social media. So we're not really feeling the pressure right now. You know, we don't look at ourselves as being a news organization that feels the need to compete with other people. Our first job is to get the news and to get the information out there, and we'll let the chips fall where we may from that. So I'm quite happy with that approach.
And when you find the time, Adam, you're also a singer-songwriter and musician. With COVID-19 making its way, are you getting a chance to perform live again for audiences?
Bit by bit. And I actually, believe it or not, have just started taking bookings for Christmas. I actually started getting calls about doing Christmas shows on the last week of August. So it's starting to come into that special season, so we'll be putting pins down in those. But I am starting to get a few more calls and a few more requests for performances, and it's really been wonderful for me, whether I'm doing something like the Tuesday Night Kaylee series at the Port Hawkesbury Civic Center, or even just playing at local seniors' homes. I've been at the Richmond Villa and St. Peter's twice in the last month and a half. So we're slowly pulling back the curtain on that. I know some other musicians have taken a more aggressive approach, but if balancing COVID concerns with the news work I'm doing right now, I've had to walk a kind of a tightrope than some other musicians might have had. But I'm looking forward to being able to perform more and hoping to be able to really pick that up through the fall and the winter.
And you said when you were younger you wanted to become a storyteller, and you're able to do that as in your day job as a reporter, but do you feel like you're accomplishing that through your music as well?
Well, I am, and I'm very grateful for what God has given me in terms of being able to write stories and write songs about the people and the places right here in our own backyard. I had the honor of performing on the Stan Rogers Festival main stage in 2004. And the reason I did that was because I'd written a song for the 400th anniversary of Canso being an incorporated community, and it was called We Won't Back Down. It's been recorded and released on my second album, East. And, you know, what's a kid from Grand Grave, Richmond County doing sitting on the main stage of the biggest folk festival and one of the biggest music festivals in all of Atlantic Canada and one of the biggest in the country with the likes of J.P. Cormier and Raylene Rankin sitting on the same stage with him is just remarkable. So it was a real honor for me. It continues to be an honor for years to come that I got that opportunity. But, you know, writing songs as well about things that happen in Richmond County, I still have people from Lordways that are asking me for songs that I've written about things like the Chapel Cove breakwater, or a song that I used to sing about my grandfather, Frankie I. Mumbercat. It wasn't written by me, but it was a parody of the Wabash Cannonball called the Lordways Cannonball, named after the buses that my grandpere used to drive in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And to still get requests for things like that, I wrote a song as well called Archie Neal's Cape Breton about the legendary broadcaster and storyteller himself, Archie Neal Chisholm. And I wrote it as a love letter to both Archie Neal and his legacy, but also to the community of Margaree. And I'll tell you, I've gone up to Margaree and sang that song there. they have a St. Patrick's concert every year, and I got invited to those for many years in a row. And just the warmth and the love from that audience, it's moved me to tears more than once. I will say that in terms of their thanks to me for writing a tribute to Archie Neal Chisholm. So I'm very blessed to be able to be that kind of a storyteller as well, Bill, and I hope that'll always be the case for me.
A lot of reporters will tell you, you know, some good stories fall under that section of news you can use category. And there's a song that actually would fit under that category, too. It's not news, but music you can use. Very useful, at least when you're driving up north. I always thought this was a great song that you wrote. It's called Mind the Moose. Can you talk about that one, Adam?
Mind the Moose has been good to me over the years, and it's still fun to sing. I always say half of that song is true. Because one time, this was in 2002, actually. It's hard to believe it's almost 20 years for this now. But I was booked to play at a folk festival in Bay St. Lawrence on an August night. I don't think I got on stage until something like midnight. It was quite a lengthy list of performers. They did a great job with that festival. But what happened was I stopped on the way up to Bay St. Lawrence, and I picked up my Uncle Jimmy in English. And all the way up to Bay St. Lawrence, he was telling me about places I should watch out for where moose would come out. And it felt like it was every 3 or 4 minutes he'd be pointing and in his gruff but kind voice saying, "Now that's Jack Buck's turn over there. There's going to be a moose up there. And now you watch crossing this bridge. A moose like to come out here." And I got up and I finished playing the song, the set for the Bay St. Lawrence Festival. And the organizers were asking me, "Are you staying up here tonight?" And I said, "Well, not really. I mean, I'm driving an hour south. I'm staying with my Uncle Jimmy in Inganish." "Oh, well, mind the moose. You better mind the moose." And I thought, I can make a song out of this. So I did. We didn't actually have any collision with a moose, as depicted in the second half of the song. Like I say, only half the song is true. But that wound up being a little tribute to both the Inganish and north of Smoky area. Also to my Uncle Jimmy, who loved the song. He passed away 5 years ago, and I still sing it every so often in his honor. But also just to the reality that if you're going to go drive around this jewel of Cape Breton Island, it's a beautiful, beautiful place, you better be ready to share the road with a big, dumb, shaggy beast with antlers that thinks it owns the place. So I've enjoyed it, and I'll likely enjoy singing it for a while.
Okay, so on that note, we just heard from Cape Breton musician and journalist Adam Cook, based in Port Hawkesbury, giving a tip of the cap to the late great comedy duo Huey and Alan from Cape Breton. And also we chatted about reporting and his music. And we're going to close out with a great song written by Adam. It's called "The Sun Makes Way for the Moon." Adam, always a pleasure. Let's catch up again and do this again sometime.
Eventually, the Kaylee stops. Night comes to an end, and though we might arrive as strangers, we'll depart the best of friends. And I know it won't be long before we're back here in this room, as the sun makes way for the moon. Yes, I've got a funny feeling that we'll all return here soon, as the sun makes way for the moon.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.